Radio Network, November 18th, 2014. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on TRN.FM. Our theme song, Nature Bats Last, is provided by our thanks by Afrazin. And you can find more of his work on SoundCloud at SoundCloud.com. I'm Mike Sliva, along with the good doctor, Guy McPherson. On tonight's show, we touch upon water diversions, Ferguson, the U.S.-China climate agreement. We interview Carolyn Baker, and we hear from Forrest Palmer, as well as our Doomer of the Week. Our first segment tonight highlights news beyond the mainstream echo chamber, and it comes from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. And the headline is, Divert Gila, says staff of Stream Commission. New Mexico is one step closer to deciding how to manage its share of the Gila River, now that staff members with the Interstate Stream Commission have recommended taking advantage of federal funding to build a diversion and storage system along the river. Staff also recommended during Friday's commission meeting in Silver City that 10% of the federal funding guaranteed for the Gila project, or about $7.85 million of the $78.5 million available, be spent on municipal conservation projects and other efforts aimed at stretching the region's water supplies. The recommendation infuriated a host of people who oppose the diversion on the Gila River. This is irresponsible recommendation in favor of using 90% of the available funds for a billion-dollar Gila diversion ignores the input of scientists, economists, and citizens, said Allison Sewick, director of the nonprofit Gila Conservation Coalition. The diversion puts New Mexico taxpayers on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars when the science shows that the promised water is just not there. The Interstate Stream Commission staff recommendation calls for the commission to send a letter to the U.S. Interior Department saying the state wants to develop its portion of the Gila. At stake are tens of millions of dollars in federal funding. Up to $128 million would be available if the state builds a diversion system. Critics, including environmentalists and former commission director Norman Galmay, complain that the cost of building reservoirs and pipelines for a river diversion has been estimated at more than $740 million. That's more than five times the federal dollars that would be available for the project. Here are my thoughts. There's no mention of the damage of the riparian ecosystem, of course, people before nature. We also see that there's another piece of hopium being played here in trying to propose solutions for the predicament that is our living arrangement. It's time to chase a different carrot. Our second piece from beyond the mainstream comes from Common Dreams at commondreams.org. And the headline reads, in Ferguson, a community braces for, quote-unquote, system failure. And it is written by Lauren McCauley. Expressing little hope in the U.S. system of justice, the community of Ferguson is bracing for fallout if Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson is not indicted for the shooting death of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in August of this year. A video released on Sunday by local activists and organizers shows a community prepared for the worst, with boarded-up shops spray-painted with signs that read, Open for business, Ferguson proud, pray for peace and progress. A grand jury is expected to hand down their decision any day. All of these preparations are being made with the expectation that a system that's supposed to work for everyone is going to fail once again for black people in America, says one of the interviewees. Put forth by local group HandsUpUnited.org, the video features exclusive interviews with a wide cross-section of community members, organizers, and Ferguson residents, including Mayor James Knowles III. Sunday marked 100 days since 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot at close range by Wilson and left dead in the street for over 4 hours, spurring months of widespread protest and outrage. The violent police response to a largely peaceful demonstration further ignites the community calling for an overhaul of what they say is a deeply prejudiced system, as well as for justice for Michael Brown. While activists are calling for a peaceful response, St. Louis police have indicated They are preparing for battle. On-the-ground organizers are accepting donations for goods, such as blankets, food for the community, and sanctuary spaces, and are distributing protest information, including rules of engagement, should the no-indictment rule come forward. Nobody's asking for Darren Wilson to be killed. Nobody's asking for him to be shot in the street. Nobody's asking for him to be strung up, like many for every decade and every century that we've been here, activist and actor Jesse Williams said in the video. We're asking for him to be charged with a crime that he committed in front of witnesses. No indictment is a declaration of war, added artist and Hands Up United.org co-founder Tef Poe. From the state, from the police, from the system itself, issued black and brown and oppressed and poor people of all creeds. Here are my thoughts. When your peace officers are no longer such and wear body armor, it's time for white folks to come to terms with the fact that police are nothing more than the enforcers of the state. Those who have been and continue to be killed by the state have known this since its inception. The state is at war with people, the poor and the oppressed. White privilege is the child of systemic white supremacy. It's time to move towards the exit of this living arrangement. This week in Breaking Hopium, we have Forrest Palmer and discussing the newly reached climate agreement between the U.S. and China. This is Breaking Hopium.
So out of the blue, the U.S. and China have a new deal on the table to potentially save us from climate catastrophe. Of course, like all climate talks between the United States and China, this was done in bilateral negotiations with no other country in the room and no input from those who will be most affected in the short term in the global south, a place where we are continuously seeing thousands of humans die each year from that region due to climate change. So let's look at the numbers between these two. The United States says that it's going to reach 26% to 28% of 2005 levels by 2025, and that China will cap its carbon emissions by 2030. From the American perspective, this all sounds fine and dandy if it is looked at through the prism of white privilege in the Western world. In the present, the average person in this country is entirely insulated from the daily effects of climate change. Of course, this insulation is slowly being peeled away through more frequent and intense climate catastrophes, such as Hurricane Sandy in New York a couple of years ago, and more disastrous weather problems, like the ongoing drought in California, where over half of our produce is grown. Yet we are still primarily a consumer culture that predicates our necessities in life off how much income we can generate and spend on any number of goods and services, with money being the only barrier to having whatever we want in this world in our mind's eye. Therefore, the natural world really means nothing to us, since in this industrialized society, we are totally detached from it, as we have lost connection from nature and see it as only a place to get resources for economic growth and personal comfort. Little else concerns us, since our entire existence is built upon the byproduct of using said resources, which are processed, manufactured, and delivered to us on a daily basis. The arbitrary basis for 2005 levels and 26% to 28% of that is as meaningless as any other wholly manufactured target generated by the government. Just a number to allow those few who care about this to believe that something is being done while we continue on the only path we have ever known, which is business as usual. On the other side, China is the greatest gross emitter of carbon in the world, as its growing economy, manufacturing base, and standard of living for a slight few of its residents is increasing every year. So in that country's portion of this so-called agreement, it can emit carbon with no regulations other than themselves for the next 16 years, as long as they show a decline by 2030. This means that China can go on a veritable spree of burning as much carbon as possible with no oversight whatsoever for the next decade. If anything, this gives the country a window to push forward with building infrastructure at a frenetic pace, which will help economic growth in the short term, as well as allow the country to base its decline off a slight decrease in billions of tons of additional carbon emissions over the next decade. That is, if it is even able to do this. As this is a non-binding agreement, and I have seen the outcome of all the other non-binding climate agreements that preceded this one, I won't hold my breath waiting for the results. Once again, if you don't learn from history, you are bound to repeat it. As Kyoto in 1997 was the first tepid attempt at a global agreement between nations to do something about carbon emissions, we saw that not only was nothing done, but it's become much worse in the intervening years. Another old saying is, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Well, after almost 20 years of broken promises in which none of them would have solved the problem anyhow, shame will be the least of our worries in the not-too-distant future.
Carolyn Baker, PhD, is the author, most recently, of Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. Her previous books include Navigating the Coming Chaos, a handbook for inner transition that was published in 2011, and Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse, from 2009. She's a former psychotherapist and professor of psychology and history who offers life coaching for people who want to live more resiliently in the present as they prepare for the future. Her forthcoming book, scheduled for publication in 2015, is titled Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, The Relationships We Need to Thrive. Carolyn lives and writes in Boulder, Colorado, and manages her website from there, carolynbaker.net. She also hosts the Lifeboat Hour on this network. You can catch it at 9 p.m. Eastern Time every Sunday. Welcome to Nature Bites Last, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Guy. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Excellent. I'm gratefully serving as a guest on your webinar.
Yes.
The webinar is a natural component of your work. Please tell us how it came to be and what your goals are for this particular webinar.
Sure. I chose to create this webinar, Relationships in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, How Do We Love and How Do We Leave?, somewhat as a result of our publishing our recent book, which we'll talk about in a minute. But besides the fact that I love doing webinars and that it's a great way to get my work out into the world in a way that promotes dialogue, I chose to set this one up. And my webinar in February, Befriending the Dark Emotions, Healing in Turbulent Times, was very successful. And so much has changed since February. I've changed since February. And it felt like it was time to do another online gathering. Also, I want to add that, as everyone knows, my work deals with our emotional and spiritual preparation for and responses to the collapse of industrial civilization and catastrophic climate change. And I just don't see enough places where people have the opportunity to talk about this. Obviously, we have a few online support groups for this, but beyond that, there isn't much. And I want to add that once we allow these dire issues of abrupt climate change and collapse to really sink into our consciousness, and we start understanding what they really mean, and what they really mean is our physical demise and the extinction of our species, then we're no longer in the territory of science or facts or intellectual debate. I like to use the analogy of being on a train that has finally come to the end of the line, the train being our waking up, our staying with what we know and not going back into denial. So near-term human extinction is the end of the line. And once the tracks run out, we have to decide if we're going to stay on the train and end our lives or get off the train and keep walking as far as we can. If we choose to keep walking as far as we can, then we have to make our lives mean something. We have to make sense of our lives and make meaning in terms of our past, and we have to make meaning in terms of how we want to live our lives for the rest of the time that we have. One of the most powerful and helpful ways that I've found to do this is by doing grief work. And I know, Guy, that you have a lot to say about this, and I'm eager to dialogue with you about it. But I can't really emphasize enough how important this work is. You frequently say, if you're damned if you do, and if you're damned if you don't, then do. So doing means realistic activism that isn't trying to save the world, but that is alleviating the suffering of the world and one's own suffering. Most people don't understand that grief work is activism. And on this, I'd just like to read a quote from my friend Francis Weller, whom I consider a foremost expert on grief. And in his little book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, he says, "Grief is a powerful form of soul activism. If we refuse or neglect the responsibility for drinking the tears of the world, her losses and deaths cease to be registered by the ones meant to be the receptors of that information. It is our job to feel these losses and to mourn them. It is our job to openly grieve for the loss of wetlands, the destruction of forest systems, the decay of whale populations, the erosion of soil, and on and on." Now, I found that most people, when they have a safe and supportive place to grieve, really can't wait to do it. Most people are carrying the burden of tons of grief, and they don't realize how much they're carrying until they start allowing themselves to go there.
Hi, Carolyn. This is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
You know, on that point of grief, I really
enjoyed the chapter on hospice and extinction dialogues, and I'm always fascinated by the response of my friends and how they take the news of climate change and collapse, and sometimes they end up in their closet, in a fetal position because they feel hopeless and helpless. And your chapter brought to light some really insightful things for me, and one of them is that grief can actually, I guess, give you an opportunity to really discover your spirituality and discover mm-hmm. your spirit, and really a way maybe to, even once you discover that spirit, to protect it. And I was wondering if you could talk about grief as being maybe a doorway, as you put it, to your spirituality.
Well, it absolutely is a doorway to our spirituality and lots of things. You know, it's like when I allow myself to grieve, I begin to go deeper and deeper into the psyche, and I begin to get in touch with a part of myself that actually kind of paradoxically can never be touched by sorrow and loss and the things that are going on in the world. You know, part of me that's something greater than, you know, my mind, my intellect, my ego. And then that begins to kind of help me start making sense of, you know, my life in the context of possibly a larger picture. It definitely connects me with other people. You know, I know that the Gaia's experience and I've experienced in doing grief workshops, you know, that it really so deeply connects people with each other. And I like to do the grief workshops a lot outside in nature and allow people to just do some of the grieving in nature and connect with the earth as they do that. So it's a fabulous connector. It's a fabulous doorway into our spirituality. And another paradox that people don't really realize is that grief, when we really consciously grieve with support, we begin to experience more joy in our lives and more of a sense of aliveness. This is the feedback I get from people that do my grief workshops all the time.
That's a great point, and it reminds me, as most things do, of a little clip with Louis C.K. He's being interviewed by Conan, and he's talking about how he hates cell phones, which seems like an interesting diversion, but it's quite related. And he talks about how we don't allow ourselves to fully grieve, to immerse ourselves in deep sadness. Instead, we look for a distraction, like texting somebody on a cell phone. And by not allowing ourselves to experience deep sadness, we also don't allow ourselves to experience great joy.
Exactly.
And that's exactly right, and it takes a comedian to point it out to us.
Right. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I mean, that's so frequently the case with our culture, is mm-hmm. that we have truth tellers, and they always have to include a laugh, or they have to be sitting on a fast horse, one or the other, when they tell the truth.
Exactly.
So that's a nice lead-in. Thanks for that, Mike. For our book, just published, Extinction Dialogues, is just out. You mentioned your webinar in February and how much has changed since then. For one thing, we hatched the idea of writing a book together. We wrote it, and then it was published last month. Can you tell us the story from your perspective of the book and how we created it and how it arrived in print form?
Sure. Well, as you know, my friend Andrew Harvey, who's the author of more than 30 books, including one entitled Sacred Activism, Andrew's been struggling for the last year with NTHE, near-term human extinction. And I've shared much of your information with him, Guy, and he's really been conflicted about it. But he finally came to the place where he realized that the science can't be refuted. And he opened his mind and heart to the reality of near-term extinction. Andrew's a very passionate person, and he's been an enormous publication coach for me in the sense of nudging me to write about various things. So he suggested that you and I write a book in which we integrate the science of NTE with the existential realities. He's solidly connected with North Atlantic Books in Berkeley, California. He's written for them for a long time. They're a division of Random House, which is also the publisher of my book, Collapsing Consciously, and the publisher of my forthcoming book. So you and I agreed that we wanted to have How to Live with Death in mind as a subtitle, and North Atlantic didn't want to take that on. They didn't want to take on the subtitle or the facts of climate science in the book. They just couldn't quite go there. So Tan Lane found us shortly thereafter, and it took us, I guess, about 6 weeks to complete the book. But specifically, I think we've written a book that integrates and weaves together the scientific and the psycho-spiritual in a very no-nonsense and succinct way. Again, it's nearly impossible and maybe even, in fact, I don't know, brutal to subject oneself to the realities of climate science without having a way to make emotional and spiritual meaning from it. I always say that when humans have to deal with what I call the Big Five, love, death, suffering, the sacred, and eternity, it's really not possible to do so from an exclusively intellectual perspective. So I think we've provided an integration in the book that hopefully will inspire people to go deeper into the realm of making meaning, and that's part of what my webinar is about as well.
Right. You mentioned how quickly we wrote the book. It was an inspiring experience for me, and I think for you as well, this idea of dialogue, of writing a little bit and sending it to you, and then you'd write something back, and that would remind me and encourage me and inspire me to write another paragraph or six. And so it went stunningly quickly. I don't like to tell people how quickly we wrote it, because then they think, $25 and it took you a week? Come on.
But, right.
That out.
Well, you know, as I've heard some people say, prose is a terrible thing to waste. So you and I had lots of prose in our back pockets that we could put together and share with each other and pretty quickly come up with a book.
That's right. It was the quickest project I've ever done.
It was easy and fun also, I got to say.
Yeah, and as I understand it, you were a little hesitant, maybe even reluctant, because you hadn't written a book with somebody before. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I hadn't written a book with somebody before, and, you know, I've heard all these horror stories, and, you know, one of the horror stories that sticks in my mind is, you know, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter talking about how they almost divorced over writing a book because it was so intense and difficult, and so, you know, I like you, Guy, and I want to keep you as a friend, and, you know, it's like, oh my God, what's this gonna do to our friendship? You know, but that was a vastly overrated fear, and it was really nothing but pure joy for me.
Well, yeah, I've written several books with other people, and I was extremely reluctant because I know about all those horrors, all of those terrible. When you're writing a book, because it's a pretty intimate experience,
mm-hmm.
We conduct completely online. But still, you're revealing thoughts and emotions that, for the most part, this culture tells us to keep hidden.
Yeah, and you know, we both come from academic backgrounds, and we know how that environment is, right? And I mean, you know, it's so critical and it's so ego-based, and so, you know, it could be really easy to fall into that. You know, well, you shouldn't say it that way. You should say it my way. But we didn't get into any of that.
That's right. And it is an incredibly harshly critical environment, I think, because the stakes are just so small that everybody has to pile on with their big egos. It doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Right.
You're pretty prolific, at least lately. Tell us about your 2015 book, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, The Relationships We Need to Thrive. When's it scheduled for publication? How does
yeah.
it work, that sort of thing?
Well, it's scheduled for publication in March, and I wrote it for a number of reasons. One being that in recent years, I've really been captivated with the reality that everything in our lives is a relationship. You know, and relationship is one of the things that this culture really doesn't do well. We're so individualistic. But the truth is we have relationships with partners and children and family and our work, our food, the earth, our bodies. Everything is a relationship. And this book kind of highlights 16 of thousands of relationships that we have with everyone and everything. And it asks, you know, how do we engage in those relationships in a time of ecological apocalypse? Over the years, I've had countless numbers of people contact me to get support around being in a relationship with a partner who doesn't want to hear about collapse or NTE. Sometimes people want guidance around how to talk with children or extended family members and friends about these very difficult subjects, and what to do with their emotions if the doors are closed and they can't have these conversations. Or sometimes people want to relocate to other parts of the country or the world, and they need guidance, or they need spiritual mentoring, or just straight up want to do grief work. But the most important ingredient in my forthcoming book and in the current webinar, and really my work with folks in general, is love. The subtitle of the webinar, How Do We Love, How Do We Leave? How do we have intimate relationships with, you know, all aspects of our lives and savor and cherish and hold them close to our hearts in this time of endings? We have very little in this culture that demonstrates how to love, how to care, how to feel and express compassion. And I believe that humans inherently know how to love and care deeply, but we've been so wounded and we've become so jaded emotionally that it's very difficult for many of us to give and receive authentic love. And really, how tragic that the most important thing we need to be doing in a time of extinction, giving and receiving love, we can't do because our capacity to do this has been crippled.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think part of it is because it seems like when we present this information, a lot of it for people is just a bunch of data and numbers. And people really have a hard time coming to terms without a narrative. And we're a storytelling species, clearly, because we live in, the dominant culture lives in what I would consider to be the ultimate story. So I was wondering, how do we piece together a narrative of discovery so people can come to these places that often entail grief and then hopefully love? How can we put together a narrative of discovery so folks can come to these things really on their own terms? Because, you know, there are very few people talking about near-term human extinction and abrupt climate change and collapse. But how do we, as people who are talking about those things, really create a narrative for people to come to these places on their own? This is for both of you, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. Guy, go ahead and take that one on, and let me think a little bit, okay?
Creating a story is tough, and I don't, you know, I'm a storyteller. I'm not as good at it as my older brother, who, interestingly enough, was once offered a job as a storyteller in a tavern. And my stories come to me through experience. I'm not sure how to incorporate other people's experiences into my story that don't touch me directly. Going to have to think about this one for a while.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is a big struggle, too, because I talk, when I do get out and speak, I'm generally talking to staff members in high schools and high school students. And if I throw, you know, a bunch of how the temperature is and the climate is going to change and give them a bunch of data, they'll just look at me and stare blankly, and it'll go over their heads, or they just won't care and remain apathetic. And so I find that I have to generally go back to the drawing board in some cases because it's kind of a crash-and-burn scenario when I go into these places. You never know what audience you're going to get. And, you know, the two of you have spoken in front of enough people that, you know, you find certain things that generally work and connect with an audience. And I guess basically that's what I'm looking for is, you know, what has worked for you that you can, you know, you can give them this narrative and they come along for the ride, so to speak.
Well, I can speak to that to some extent. I'm a storyteller, definitely, and I often tell my stories with an African drum. And the stories I tell are usually ancient stories that come from indigenous tribes or that come from ancient Greek mythology. You know, those stories are so archetypal and so universal. They speak to these big five things that I talked about, you know, the big questions of human existence. And even though they might have been written thousands of years ago, we still resonate with them today because those questions haven't really changed. And so I often tell these stories, and I ask people when I tell the story, like I take a few minutes afterwards to ask them how it grabbed them and what they feel in their bodies. And that really creates an opening to start talking about and drawing connections with the current situation and extinction. And, you know, extinction has now become a very mainstream word. You know, we've got it everywhere. Elizabeth Colbert's book on the sixth great extinction. We have it, you know, all over the internet. And so, you know, sadly, it's kind of become so common that it's losing its meaning. But we can still bring in because, you know, many of those ancient societies were facing extinction at the time the stories were told. And we don't hear about those people anymore, you know, and, oh, this comes from the so-and-so tribe that doesn't exist anymore, but hey, it connects with us today.
Right. With respect to storytelling, I'm reminded of the first, quote, professional presentation I ever did. I was in graduate school, and I was presenting at the Society for Range Management Meetings in Salt Lake City, Utah, in February of 1984. Four, as I recall.
And exactly.
and one of the faculty members, Carlton Britton, who was on my graduate advisory committee, gathered a bunch of us students together, a bunch of us graduate students who were going to present. And he sat there and forced us all to do a trial run in front of each other. And it was awful. It was just, and I was reading from these little note cards, and it was just horrible. And he comes up after I'm done, and he takes away my note cards, and he says, "Now do it again." And I was horrified because I'm so reliant upon the information in front of me that I couldn't tell the story. And so I struggled through it for the next five or six times with him, but then I got up there in Salt Lake City, and I used the note cards. And it was as horrible as it was the first time. That was the last time I ever used note cards and read a presentation like that.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively recently, I did a speaking tour in California, and my host, we got to the first presentation, and my host, Peter Melton, says, "Okay, this time we're not going to use any PowerPoint. You don't need a crutch. You know this story. You need to connect with these people. You need to look them in the eye." And so there I was back in graduate school 30 years ago, wondering how I'm going to do this, except I'm a little better at it now than I was then. I like to think. And he was right that not relying on the scientific data, which are clear at this point, is pretty useful for a lot of audiences. We came away from that experience, and we did that several times after that, and we very early on started co-presenting. And still a lot of the feedback was, "I'd like to see more science." And so we're still struggling with, at our presentations, how much science we give them and how much story we tell.
Yeah.
Because not everybody is going to be convinced that human extinction is going to happen in the near term just because we say so.
Right.
So the data are important, too. The evidence has to be presented in some form. And so that remains the struggle, I guess, is how much of it is just a story and how much of it is a story founded in evidence and rooted in that evidence. So that's the work for me going forward, at least.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in your work, Carolyn, are you more inclined to be in audiences when you're doing something live, to be in more intimate settings, more smaller settings where you can, I guess, get across a little more personal experiences from the people that you're actually talking to? And incorporate their narrative into the presentation itself?
Well, I certainly can do that when I'm in person. It's, you know, much more difficult to do that online, you know, when you're speaking to a couple hundred people or whatever online. That's one of the things I really try to do in workshops in person is get people involved in telling their own stories and particularly relating to grief, and just creating a space where it's safe and supportive for people to really, really get into this emotion.
Yeah, I think that's vitally important, is creating the space. It seems to me that when I first started teaching and we would, I would try to get some piece of information across to my class, it was more of me just talking to them. And I found out after a few frustrating years that actually getting them involved and getting them to buy in, really, long-term, it taught me a great deal about not only myself and what I was trying to get across, but how to become a better teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just watching Guy over the years, since I've known him since 2008, he's become a much better storyteller. And I think he's really connected with people. And I think in large part that's why his audience has grown. And I think both of you are doing a great job really putting a narrative together, which, quite frankly, nobody else is doing in the world, and you two are part of that. And I think that's something you should be very proud of, and the book is a great example of that.
Well, thank you for that. And, you know, one of the things I know for sure is that people look at us as people. You know, I mean, when we go out and make a presentation, people are looking at who we are. And they're not looking at our credentials as much as they're looking at how we come across. And, you know, like I've heard many people, you know, refer to Guy as a man who really has a huge heart. And, you know, yeah, he's standing up there giving us all this science with the PowerPoints, but it's very clear that he's a heartful person. And that's what people want. I mean, they don't want just the facts. They want to see who we are. Are we approachable? You know, do we understand? Are we on the same wavelength? Do we have empathy? And that's a huge one. Do we have empathy for their situation? And
yeah, vulnerability is. It seems that you both show vulnerability, and I think that's important. People don't put you up on this pedestal necessarily all the time, and you're very approachable, and you can have conversations within the actual presentation, which doesn't always happen in an academic setting. So.
Exactly. And, you know, the whole thing that Guy has experienced and I have experienced of traveling around, being in people's homes and, you know, sharing meals with people and just being where they live and how they live is so important.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're joined today by speaker, author, and life coach Carolyn Baker. With respect to life coaching, Carolyn, I'd like you to put on your life coaching hat for a moment. I'm stuck between pragmatism and principle. I've been promoting and practicing a gift economy for many years. So far, it's running about 20 to 1 and not in my general direction. I've been offered opportunities to monetize my work, a notion that goes against principle but is consistent with continuing to eat. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for me.
Well, as I was thinking about this question earlier, you know, if we want to talk about jaded, let's talk about our perceptions of resources in this culture. In my forthcoming book, I have an entire chapter on our relationship with resources, including money. And I'm finding that the gift economy is being wildly misunderstood, and how could it not be in a culture so jaded about money? I really invite people to read what Charles Eisenstein has written about the gift economy, specifically in Sacred Economics. But let me say what I think the gift economy is not. The gift economy is not the notion that I give everything away for free and that if I don't, I'm some kind of avaricious capitalist pig. You and I need to eat and pay bills. You and I need, and I emphasize need, certain things in order to do the work we do. As long as the economy of industrial civilization is chugging along, this is going to be true. And the way I work the gift economy is that I ask for a particular fee, for example, for my webinar or the price of a book. If a person has a difficult time paying the price of a book or an event, I would like that person to come to me and discuss their hardship. And in the process of building a relationship, we come together and we talk about that, and we come to some sort of agreement about the price. For some events, I might say no one will be turned away, suggested donation is. But what troubles me deeply and turns me off big time is when someone makes a comment on Facebook or on a website that says, gee, why don't these people understand income equality in this culture? I can't register for this event because I don't have the money. Or, oh my God, Carolyn Baker wrote another book and she's charging money for it again. And clearly all she wants to do is get rich. So let me emphasize that the gift economy works both ways. If all you're doing is expecting me to give you something, that's not the gift economy. What are you bringing to the table? What will you give to the workshop or webinar or event for which I'm charging money? This kind of whining is simply an extension of the entitlement with which we've been inculcated. What kind of value do you place on the work that another person is offering you? For example, you could say to a workshop presenter, I really don't have the money to pay the full fee for the workshop, but I could pay 50% of it, and I can spend my time and energy networking, promoting online, promoting it in the media, handing out flyers, talking it up big time so that we get lots of people there. Or they might ask, is there a scholarship arrangement I could utilize? I'm happy to register people, help clean up after the workshop, make tea or coffee, hand out materials, and so on. And when people contact me for life coaching, they sometimes want to work on issues of lack and prosperity. And I have some very powerful tools that I'm very happy to help them implement. And I can assure you that without exception, utilizing those tools is going to shine a huge light on their cultural and personal wounding around money. But if those tools are implemented, I rarely see them fail the person using them. So I support you, Guy, in monetizing your work in a way that feels most comfortable to you, being willing to negotiate with people in terms of the gift economy, and really knowing the value of the work you have to offer the world. If you were actually my coaching client, I'd probably want to hear more from you about some of the experiences and attitudes that have brought you to the dichotomy of pragmatism and principle, because it might be a false one. I don't know. I'm just saying.
I charge him for that.
You bring up a good point, that of resources. We tend to view the world as resources instead of as relations. We view other species as resources, which inherent in the use of that word is exploitation. We
yes.
used to have health departments at corporations and organizations, and now we have departments of human resources because
mm-hmm.
we're all... Yeah. And so that's one of those words that really triggers me because the entire society has become focused on what's in it for me, what do I get from this.
Right. And that's one of the reasons I wrote my forthcoming book is, you know, to juxtapose relationship and resource, you know, and to come to everything we do in relationship, not as it all being focused on the resources we have or don't have.
Right. I mean, that's really how Guy and I became friends, is really through the gift economy and really through building a relationship. It was no money involved whatsoever. It was a work exchange,
mm-hmm.
more or less. And he came and offered for Karen and I to come to his property and really just spend a weekend or two and helping him do a little bit of construction and a little bit of gardening. And then it worked long term, where we came to a point where we spent a summer here. And again, we helped them with projects, and they basically, you know, put us up and fed us, and no money was exchanged. And it really built a relationship that is one of the more stronger relationships that I have. And now, you know, I share part of the property, and it's really, I think, a testament to the gift economy. It's really what started the relationship that we have. And I encourage more people to really put themselves out there and not look about what they're trying to get out of it, but, you know, build that relationship, as you said, and then see how we can help each other out. You know, what do I have to offer Guy as a skill set, and what can I learn from him, and vice versa.
Right.
So I think Charles' book is a great start for that, as you mentioned.
Right, absolutely.
For speaking of gift economy and pursuing a life of service, for many years I've pondered the notion of service, particularly in light of the alleviation of suffering. I don't know why some people are committed to lives of service and others clearly are not. Can you comment on that idea?
Yeah. I don't necessarily believe that everyone should live a life of service, but whatever our calling in life, we all have opportunities to alleviate suffering. Our culture is clearly an anti-service culture. It's all about entitlement and getting what I need for me and mine and screw you. Many people are terrified of other beings who need our service, such as the homeless, abused animals and people, people in hospice, or people who have terminal illnesses and so on. And I'm noticing a lot of stories lately in the news, more than ever, about ordinary people who are paying it forward, like leaving $1,000 tips for no reason. And the man who just got arrested in Fort Lauderdale for feeding homeless people on the street. And people are verbalizing endlessly how good it feels to do service and be generous. Again, back to our conversation on resources and the personal and cultural wounding that people have around money. Many people have no idea how good service and generosity feel, but most people are very scared to take the risk of experiencing it. And also, I think we should note here that living a life of service does not mean you don't get paid for it, as if choosing a life of service means taking a vow of poverty. I've always lived a life of service, and most of the time I've gotten paid for it.
That's a good point, and I love that you bring up the 90-year-old man who was arrested in Florida for helping feed the homeless. It's just another example of how this entire culture fails to reward and in some cases punishes people who are trying to help others. It's astonishing to me, and I tell myself every day when I read something like that, I tell myself I could never be surprised again because nothing that's more absurd than this could possibly happen. And then the next day, there I am, surprised again.
Right, right.
I think part of it is, you know, the conversations that I have online with people sometimes is, it seems to me that, and I find this particularly with the white men in my life, that they feel that everything that is wrong in society is because a particular group of people, and they're very, very careful in how they say this because they speak in code now, are not pulling their weight, quote unquote, is generally the line I get from, generally it always seems to come from people within my family who are white males. And they're so concerned with a particular group of people in society who are not pulling their weight, and therefore they feel that, why should I lead a life of service because these people are, quote-unquote, taking advantage and making it tougher on everyone. But what they fail to do, it seems to me, is they fail to look further up the hierarchy to the big fish. And they always seem to look people below them, and then when I bring up things like, you know, well, the idea of justice, sometimes it stymies them, but most of the time they just get angry, and, mm-hmm. and again, they reach back to people are not pulling their weight, and I was wondering if that's anything that you guys run into, you and Carolyn run into at all with any of your audience.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about this whole notion of pursuing a life of service and what allows me to do that and why I do it. What allows me to pursue a life of service is the passion I feel about the work I do and the reality that I cannot not do it. And there's another piece here, too, and that is about having my heart cracked open and broken. And again, this is the value of doing grief work. Because of having my heart broken open, I'm able to do some kinds of service today that I couldn't have done 5 years ago. And on this, I'd like to say something about a type of service I've been doing in the last 6 months for which I'm not paid. In May of this year, I developed a connection on the street with a homeless man and his dog. He's not crazy. He's very bright. And I have very stimulating conversations with him. He became a huge fan of my book, Collapsing Consciously. In fact, he said, gee, somebody's written a book from my perspective for a change. And he's read Extinction Dialogues and loves it. And he told me that he wants to read everything on collapse that he can. And I have a big box of books on collapse that I was going to give away, but I'm gradually doling them out to him. He passes the books around to other homeless people. So right now there's a whole collapse NTE library on the streets of Boulder, Colorado. And I've been taking him out for lunch once a week and babysitting for his 14-year-old dog when she needs a vacation from being on the street. They've been together for that long, and she's his principal source of love and connection in the world. And it's a long story why he's not choosing to use the homeless shelter here in Boulder, but he isn't. And we've had sub-zero temperatures here for the last 3 days. So he and his dog have been sleeping in the back of my pickup truck, which has a camper shell on it. And he's been so grateful to be off the streets that he acts like he's on the beach in Hawaii. He slept in an underpass for two of those sub-zero nights, and I don't think he would have made it through the third one. If he has to sleep in my truck every night this winter, that's okay with me. It's the least I can do. Am I inconvenienced? A little bit. But if I weren't, would it be service? I don't know. So you can ask to what end we do service. My answer, because it's the right thing to do. Because we don't own the planet. We're just paying rent to be here. And part of our rent is to serve the Earth community. And the cherry on top of the sundae is that it feels really, really good.
So do you think that sometimes in order to maybe pursue a life of service, or not even a life, but just service in general, that it has to touch people personally?
Personally, and have the heart open, you know. And we're a society of hardened hearts, and, you know, we're a society where one of the top causes of death is congestive heart failure, because our hearts are shut down, they're constricted, and when our hearts get open through grief work or whatever it is, you know, the compassion tends to flow, and we start looking around for ways that we can serve.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. In response to your question, Mike, for me at least, the pushback always comes from white men, the men who are the people who are benefiting most from the system as it currently exists are resistant to any change in the system, whether that comes from the ongoing collapse of the industrial economy or the collapse of the climate system or the collapse of ecosystems. It doesn't really matter, because any change is viewed as bad. For the most part, this pushback comes from people who consider themselves progressive, or leftists, as if there's any left in this country at this point.
Word.
So you've already commented on what allows you or forces you to pursue a life of service. It's something you feel like you don't have any control over.
Right.
Is that a correct interpretation?
Yeah, that's pretty much it, you know. It's like I cannot not do this anymore, just like I cannot not do my own work in the world that I do get paid for.
Right. And that service for you extends beyond what you get paid for, and the pay isn't that great. And so you mentioned one of the benefits is that it feels good. What else? Is there more? Is there more benefit to you that comes from helping?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In this particular situation, with this particular connection, in many ways, it's been a huge education. I would say it's like postdoctoral studies in the reality of homelessness and poverty in this country. A really, really close look into lack of mental health services, what the poverty scene really is. And another thing that kind of surprised me is, you know, I've bad-mouthed Obamacare a lot, and I still, mostly for people like us, I do bad-mouth it. But for the very lowest rungs on the ladder, like my friend who's homeless, this guy gets total Medicare. He's got really, really good health care. Anything that happens to him, it's taken care of. So, you know, for all of the pluses and minuses of Obamacare, I will really feel badly to see it go away, because it's going to affect some of the most hurting, suffering people in this culture.
Well, of course, it's going away, just like everything else we've come to view as our entitlement in this system, especially for, quote, first world nations such as ourselves. Can you comment on that, on the timing at which you see things decaying in the past and into the future? Now, I know predictions are hard, especially about the future, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, this election pretty much, you know, convinced me, you know, and I certainly do not have any faith in either one of the political parties by any stretch, but it really convinced me of something that I've seen historically, is that when societies are really, really going into collapse, they tend to drift to the right. And they tend to want to have leaders who will take control, who will make everything stable and, you know, fix things and get things back on the road again. And I think that this country is going into the wide open arms of fascism, power and control, because that makes us feel better. And I think we're massively deceived. And, yes, I think things are speeding up in terms of the decline. And... I think it's going to be a pretty scary next decade.
Yeah, as George Carlin famously said, this country's finished.
Thank you very much, Carol. Thanks for taking the time to spend with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And this is Nature Bad Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks again to Carolyn Baker for spending 50 minutes of her day with us today.
Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo for their rhetoric or analysis, but also provides insightful and useful information to the issues at hand. Our doomer of the week this week is John Luty. John writes in a private Facebook page, "I'm kind of tired, burnt out, soul dead, and a growing part of myself just wants to disengage from just about everything and everyone and find a nice beach somewhere warm and lie on it every day, reading until the money runs out, and then let the tide take me so I can go home to pure white light." Indeed, John. Finally, we generally close most shows with a climate summary and update, and that can be found at naturebadsblast@guymcpherson.com. Nothing from Guy this week, but his blog has a new look with some goodies, so check it out. Well, y'all, that about does it for this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bad Blast, and the Progressive Radio Network. And join our Nature Bad Blast on PRN.FM group on Facebook as well. Make sure you post your questions you would like us to address in the show, because the show is pre-recorded so we can no longer take live calls. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at Nature Bad Blast for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We will see you next Tuesday evening. If you miss us, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, Nature Bats Last. Thanks again, Afrizen, for our theme song.
Every year of my life, that's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year, we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year, there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year, there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day into extinction. We're about to see that turn around.